The views expressed on Science for the People are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
It's just a tiny embryo at that point, and trying to get the dose right of a steroid and trying to hit only what you're expecting to hit, which is the brains and the genitals, and not affecting any other organ, is almost impossible. It is impossible.
This is Science for the People, and my guest is Alice Dreger, author of Galileo's Middle Finger. Hello and welcome to Science for the People. I'm Desiree Schell, and today I have Alice Dreger with me. Alice is a professor of clinical medical humanities and bioethics at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine and the author of Hermaphrodites and the Medical Invention of Sex, One of Us, Conjoined Twins, and the Future of Normal. And she's here to talk about her newest book, Galileo's Middle Finger, Heretics, Activists, and the Search for Justice in Science. Welcome, Alice.
Hey, Desiree. Thanks so much for having me.
Can we just start out by talking about the marketing for this book? Because when we requested a copy from the publisher, I was fairly certain that what I'd receive was a history of classic scientific rebels, the ones who searched for empirical truth, even when they personally or ideologically, it would have been inadvisable. But that is not this book. Would you agree?
I would agree. Yeah. You know, it's funny because when you're inside a book for several years, which we were, myself, my agent, my editor, and all of that, you kind of get so into it that you're not quite thinking about how other people will think about it. And this book, as you know, is a strange book in many ways. It's a strange genre, but it also goes through a huge amount of content. And so the title Galileo's Middle Finger was something I had come up with. The subtitle, which, as it turns out, confuses people even more, Heretics, Activists, and the Search for Justice in Science, didn't fix for people what it was about. And then the front cover, which shows Galileo, an old painting of Galileo, with his hand kind of blurred out, implying he's holding his middle finger, is actually brilliant once you've read the book, because it's a
yes.
It's a look at a classic scientist living in the digital age, kind of being manipulated and misrepresented. Unfortunately, it works after you read the book, so in some ways it's a challenge. So we're changing the cover for the paperback, but we haven't come up with a solution yet.
Well, let's explain what this book is. It's part memoir of a science historian turned activist, then maybe turned a different kind of activist, but it's also an expose of scientific controversies that definitely reads more like a thriller. But then it's also a discussion of the science and politics of intersex and trans issues. And at least that's how I tried to explain it to people after I read the whole book in one sitting. So how do you explain the book?
You know, for people who are in history of science, it's easy for me. I tell them it's like my own personal Voyage of the Beagle, which was Charles Darwin's account of what it was like traveling for 5 or 6 years, I forget which, around the world, looking at different species and looking at the natural world. So to me, it's kind of a travelogue. It is a memoir in the sense that it takes you through the stuff that I've learned, but it leaves out a whole bunch of other stuff I do, and it focuses specifically on these wars between scientists and activists. In some ways, it's a travelogue in a war-torn land. So it's not just we're traveling around, going through all these different controversies, looking at how they played out. But in addition to that, like, people are actively shooting at each other while it's going on. So I'm in there kind of occasionally the Red Cross, occasionally a partisan, flipping over on one side or the other if I think the other side is really out of line. So it depends sort of where we go. But people have told me it reads like a thriller because it goes through all of these different controversies and kind of my own experience trying to survive all of it.
Okay, well, let's try to begin at the beginning.
Okay.
How did you become an activist?
Well, my parents were and are conservative Roman Catholics and right-to-life activists. They're retired from activism now because they're in their 80s. But I was raised on abortion clinic picket lines. I was raised with a family that brought in people who were struggling with unwanted pregnancies. And so I was really, in some ways, raised in an activist household. My dad actually ran for Congress at one point in New York on the Right to Life party line. So my parents were very much, you sort of put your feet where your mouth is kind of people. And when I went to graduate school, I started working on gender in science because I was a feminist and am a feminist, very interested in issues of gender. My dissertation director suggested that I look at the history of hermaphroditism, which is when you have a sex type that's in between the male and the female. And I thought I'd look at Darwin's barnacles and embryology because those were areas of hermaphroditism. But he said, no, no, look at medicine. And I thought, why? This doesn't happen in humans, because I'd never heard of it. I was 25 years old. Happening in humans. But then when I finally did go look at the medical literature, I found just hundreds and hundreds of case studies. And so this was very interesting to me. I mean, why at my age in a relatively sex progressive culture had I never heard of this? And the answer was because it was being suppressed as a cultural idea. So then I started publishing my work, which is actually about the 1800s. And people who had been born with these conditions that leave them with a sex type in between contacted me and asked me to help with their new rights movement, which was aimed at changing the medical system. And my first reaction was kind of, I do dead people. I'm a historian, not to living people. But, you know, there was this activist in me, and I had done activism myself in graduate school and stuff. And so I was very much drawn into what they did because I was very sympathetic to them. I mean, I've been raised to be very sympathetic, but I was also a feminist, somebody who believed in LGBT rights. This isn't LGBT, but it definitely was obvious to me that it was a case of a sexual minority being oppressed for stupid cultural reasons. So I got into the intersex rights movement thinking it would only take about 6 or 12 months to change the medical system, both because I'm stupid, but also it was so obviously wrong. I mean, it was, they were lying to patients about their medical histories with the claim that they couldn't handle the truth. I mean, in no other area of medicine did you win an ethics award for arguing that you should lie to patients, but that had happened that year. A Canadian student actually was given an award by the Canadian Medical Journal for arguing that you shouldn't tell women with Y chromosomes that they have Y chromosomes because they couldn't handle it. They were, you know, doing sex changes on baby boys who were born with small penises out of the idea if you had a small penis, you couldn't be a real man. So they were literally actively in the mid-1990s still sex changing boys. They were taking kids who were kind of in between the sexes and doing massive genital surgeries out of the belief that you had to have this for psychological reasons, but no evidence. So it seemed obvious to me that this was so broken. It would change quickly. And 20 years later, I'm still working on it.
Well, so what exactly were you trying to achieve?
Actually, ironically, the same thing we're trying to achieve today, 20 years in with the intersex rights movement, which is basically truth-telling, which has gotten better, but there's still failure of disclosure for minors in terms of telling them what's going on, and nobody bothers to tell them in many of the clinics, which is a problem because then they reach 18 and it's treated as a pediatric issue, and then boom, they're out in the world and still nobody remembered to tell them exactly what happened to them. Psychosocial support, referral to peer supporters, which again, clinics are still reluctant to do. They bring in psychologists when there's a crisis, when somebody's reached the point of crisis, but we say, no, bring them in right from the beginning and provide assistance because there are social stressors here. They don't, still many clinics don't refer to the support groups, even though the support groups are now mature, extremely stable, very helpful, super, super helpful. We ask that children be assigned a gender of boy or girl as a best guess in terms of where you think they're going to go, but recognize that some people will change their gender assignments. And, you know, that's true even for people who aren't born with these conditions. So just try to leave as much tissue intact as possible, not to mess with healthy tissue for social reasons. And if there's a genuine medical emergency, like somebody, a child is born with a kind of gonad that becomes cancerous quickly, and we know it's going to have a very high rate of cancer, which happens with what are called dysplastic gonads, which just means the gonads didn't form correctly in the womb. Then you do a medical intervention, but you sort out the medical from the social. It's not anything terribly radical, really. We never argued within the group that I worked with and the groups I still work with. We never argued for raising children without gender. We never argued for raising them in a third gender. We said raise them as boys or girls with best guesses based on the science we have, and then provide appropriate care. It's not that radical. It's still not that radical.
But you and your work, you made some pretty incredible gains, correct?
We did. We have. So today, many of the clinics where these kids are seen actually have much more organized clinical groups, which really helps. I'm actually the hired ethicist advising the national group that's trying to organize these groups. It's out of a CORD alliance, and it's called a translational research network, which basically means trying to take the science and trying to make it real world applicable. So there's some progress there. I'm bound by confidentiality agreements not to tell you what happens in the individual calls, but I will tell you it's still frustrating to see many instances in which care is still substandard in terms of failure to provide psychosocial counseling, referral to the support groups, and failure to do disclosure in adequate ways. So yeah, we made some gains. Most places won't sex change baby boys anymore because they're born with small penises. But what they do instead is shoot them full of hormones, trying to get the penis to be bigger, which has all sorts of risks associated with it. And then they're still actively all the time doing clitoral surgeries to reduce clitoral size simply because it's big, for no medical reason, just the assumption that a big clitoris will mean psychological problems. And we have no evidence that a big clitoris causes any psychological problems. In fact, we have lots of anecdotal evidence from women with big clitorises that it's not a big deal. In fact, men don't mind it. Women don't mind it as a lover. People don't seem to have a problem with it. But it's really frustrating in many ways. There's more attention paid today to reproductive capabilities of the males. They used to just have the attitude, males just have to have a big penis, and so forget thinking about their fertility. So they would sex change boys who had healthy testes, take them out, shoot them full of estrogen when puberty came. So that's gotten better. With the girls, they're paying a little more attention to sexual sensation, but not much. There's still amazing amounts of abuse going on within the system.
So being that that's the work that you were doing and still are, what were your thoughts when a friend of yours came to you and asked you to meet Michael Bailey, who was at that point known in the intersex and trans community as basically an enemy of the state for his research on trans issues?
Yeah, the friend of mine, Paul Vasey, who's a sex researcher in Canada and who is also a gay man, which is somewhat relevant in this conversation. Paul had actually asked me when these transgender activists had come after Bailey in 2003 to look into it then. But I didn't because, as you said, Bailey was known on my side of things as being a homophobic, transphobic jerk from what I had read about what he allegedly said. I didn't actually bother and go look at his work at the time, so bad on me and lesson learned. But there were also people on the other side asking me to get involved. The transgender activists who were going after Bailey actually asked me to help them. And again, I sort of said, you know, I'm focused on intersex issues. I'm not working on trans issues. So intersex is when your body is born between the male and the female type. Transgender is when you feel the gender assignment given to you at birth was the wrong one. So intersex is about your body and transgender is about how you feel about yourself. So they're related, but they're not the same thing. And so I was able to say, you know, I work on intersex stuff. But 3 years later, I was retiring, I thought, from intersex activism. I was leaving the Intersex Society, which I had helped lead for almost a decade. And my friend Paul Vasey said to me, well, I really, you know, think you should look at what happened to Bailey. But he first had me meet Bailey, and that really confused me because Bailey didn't come across as a heterosexist, homophobic, transphobic jerk at all. In fact, we went to dinner at a place in Boys Town that was full of gay men and folks who were all over the gender spectrum, and Bailey was perfectly comfortable and was talking with Paul about his research, which has to do with transgenderism in Samoa, and Mike was very supportive of the work, very progressive in his politics. So I was confused about that. And I ended up asking him a question about whether or not the worst charge against him, which was that Mike had sex with a transsexual research subject when she was his research subject, whether that was true. And he launched into this very weird legalistic defense without answering the question. So I became kind of interested, but I again didn't do anything. But what happened was at Northwestern, one of the activists who had gone after him most viciously, a woman named Andrea James, was invited to speak by our Rainbow Coalition group. And that Mike contacted me and said he was outraged. I was at that point, I'd moved to Northwestern and was working in the medical school, which is actually separate from where he works, but it's part of the same university. And I said, I don't really know who all these people are. Could you remind me who she is? And he sent me this stuff where she had posted pictures of his children online with their eyes blacked out, basically suggesting that Bailey had sodomized his kids. So I was kind of horrified because, you know, I was an activist, but I was like, this is not activism as I know activism. So I protested that, and she came after me. And when she came after me, then I got all this flood of mail from all these people from different sides of things. And I was absolutely fascinated. I was like, what the hell happened here? Like, nothing seems to be like what I was told it was. So I decided to set out and do a history of what had really happened. And that ended up taking a year to do. And I was working part-time at that point because I'd had a kid and was burned out and decided to leave my tenured job. So I had a lot of research time on my hands and ended up spending a year looking into what really happened.
This is Science for the People, and my guest is Alice Dreger, author of Galileo's Middle Finger, Heretics, Activists, and the Search for Justice in Science. Okay, so let's dig into Bailey's work a bit.
Sure. So the part of his work that was controversial had to do with transgender, but the book that he had put out that caused this controversy, called The Man Who Would Be Queen, actually looked at the whole spectrum of what he calls feminine male. So it looked at everybody from boys who are kind of feminine, many of whom turn out to be gay men when they grow up, we know from the science, some of whom transition, some of whom start out quite tomboyish, very typically boyish as children, but end up transitioning to become women later anyway. So he was looking at drag queens. He was looking at the whole spectrum of sort of males who are not traditionally masculine in terms of their life history or their behaviors. But the part that got him in trouble was the part on male-to-female transgenderism. What he was supporting there was a concept from the sex researcher in Canada, Ray Blanchard, who had looked at the demographics of men coming into his clinic who wanted to transition to become women. And what Blanchard found is that they broke into two groups demographically. The first group was very feminine as little boys, saw themselves as very girlish, behaved in ways that were traditionally feminine, so into social game playing more than rough sports playing, for example, attentive to their mothers, interested in wearing girls' clothing sometimes for purposes of going out. And so that group, Blanchard termed the homosexual transsexuals, which is a scientific terminology that I find very confusing, because once they transition, they appear to be straight women. They're what we would call now androphilic. In other words, they're attracted to males. And Blanchard thought that that had something to do with why they were transitioning, that not all gay men obviously need to be women, but that's a small percentage of them are androphilic, as well as feeling that they are so feminine that their lives make more sense transitioning to become women socially and legally and personally. And then the second group was the group that actually caused the controversy. So Blanchard found this group of men interested in transitioning to become women who historically had actually quite masculine histories. So they were not identified as very feminine as children. They typically had gone into male-identified professions. So quantitative fields in the sciences, for example, or just traditionally masculine fields like auto repair, or, you know, the kinds of things that if you guessed who would do that kind of job, you would typically guess a man from history. And this group was identified as straight prior to transition, so they were attracted to women. But Blanchard found that in addition to being attracted to women, they were also personally sexually aroused by the idea of being or becoming women. So again, the transition wasn't just about gender, but it was also about a sexual orientation. And Blanchard called this autogynephilia, which breaks down to auto, meaning self, gyne, meaning female, philia, directed to love, so love of oneself as a woman. And so he and Bailey both support transition for both groups of people. They don't see any reason why these folks, if they want to transition, shouldn't be absolutely fully supported, recognized as women, helped to get the surgeries and hormones they want, legally assisted, the whole nine yards. But the problem was that some folks who would be in that demographic got very upset with this because they felt that Blanchard and Bailey were painting them as sex perverts, and that in fact they claimed that this was purely about gender, had nothing to do with sexual orientation, only had to do with the feeling of being a woman trapped in a man's body. And so they reacted very hostily, first to Blanchard, but Blanchard published his work all in the sciences in these obscure journals. I mean, good journals, but, you know, places where nobody who wasn't a sex researcher or a clinician would be reading. So Blanchard in some ways didn't cause much of a stir, but Bailey's book is highly readable, very compelling, because he tells a lot of personal case studies, stories in there. And so Bailey's book was a big threat, and they came after Bailey, I think, because they needed to kill the messenger.
So in your opinion, is this partially an issue of activists saying, you know, we finally got people to understand the whole one gender mind and another gender's body concept? Don't you dare screw that up because we're making progress here? Or was it a genuine scientific disagreement?
No, I think it was the former. I think it was the feeling of, you know, we finally made progress and how dare you come and disrupt it. And Bailey, as I talk about in my book, Bailey is kind of dunderheaded when it comes to politics. I don't think he'd disagree with me. Well, he might disagree with me, but I don't care. he's what I call politically tone dumb. So it's not that he's tone deaf. He knows that what he says pisses people off, but he can't bring himself to sing along in tune. And so that causes him all sorts of problems, because even though he's very LGBT rights positive in the book, he doesn't care that the science may threaten people's rights or their rights progress. He believes that we should start with the science and give people rights based on ethics and morality. And in that case, he sees absolutely no reason why transgender women and transgender men shouldn't have their rights fully and totally supported, regardless of how they got there. He doesn't care how they got there in terms of their rights. He cares how they got there in terms of the science. And he's quite particular about saying, you know, what's true is true. And it doesn't matter if it offends somebody. The offense is misguided, in his opinion. And I think he's right to some extent in terms of what's true is true, and we have to try to pursue that. But at the same time, I'm sympathetic to the transgender activists who feel that they spent a long time trying to desexualize transgenderism because that made it palatable to the straight heterosexual population who gets freaked out at sex. But at the same time, you know, I'm sympathetic to Bailey, who says, well, that's the problem. What we should do is change the uptight, straight, heterosexist population and get them to understand if this has to do with sexuality, fine. It's still about consent. And these folks don't, you know, life is about consent. Sex is about consent. And so there's nothing wrong with being transgender by virtue of having an erotic component to your gender identity. In fact, you know, after I started working more intensely in this work, it seemed to me very clear that for, in fact, most of us, our sexualities are tied up with our gender identities. That, for example, when I'm having sex, I'm a straight woman. When I'm having sex with a man, I'm having sex as a woman. My gender is mattering to me in that equation. You know, women like me may, for example, switch roles and do pegging and that kind of thing. I hope that's okay to talk about. You know, we may do that, but even when we're doing that,
I should just tell the audience, if you want to know what that is, Google.
Google pegging. And prepare for porn.
I was going to say, maybe not the image search?
Okay. Start with Urban Dictionary, right, and it'll explain it to you. You know, even when women do that, then there's still a gendered component, because typically what we're doing is playing around with gender and playing around with our sexed bodies. And so I think it's true for all of us that, in fact, our genders and our sexual orientations are tied up with each other. But the truth of the reality of the world is most of the world doesn't get that. And so if you smash into transgender conversations and you say, oh, this is actually about sexual orientation and eroticism, then you're disrupting a lot of progress or the sense of progress. But I think it is possible to do the science and possible to progress in terms of rights without having to tell stories that are problematically oversimplified.
So you did an investigation into this case, a one-year investigation. What did you find?
Yeah, so I interviewed ultimately about 100 people, went through thousands of sources, videotapes, written sources, unpublished and published. And what I found, I thought when I set out that what I was going to find was a he said, she said story, which would be, you know, that it was complicated and each side had something valuable to say. What I found was that they had basically hit Bailey with charges that weren't true, and that there was evidence to believe that these people knew these charges weren't true, that he hadn't had sex with a woman who was his transsexual research subject, and that he hadn't made up data as they claimed he did, that he hadn't been doing a particular kind of research without ethics approval. In fact, the research that he was doing that required ethics approval had it. The other kind didn't require ethics board approval. They had hit him with all sorts of charges that, in fact, weren't true and had nearly ruined his life, nearly made him lose his job. He was a very changed person by all accounts in terms of before and after this controversy. And it was a very ugly situation. So I was scared to publish the work because these people had gone after him, and I knew exactly how they'd gone after him and that the facts hadn't mattered. And so I figured I was in for the same thing. And to some extent I was, although Mike kept telling me, well, you don't have as bad as I had it, which was so unhelpful, so incredibly unhelpful.
Well, what was that like to be targeted in that way by people who had previously supported and promoted your work and to be treated like you were anti-trans?
It was utterly disorienting, to be honest. These are people who happen to be very good at computers. A lot of them were very good at computers, and they took over my internet identity. They Google bombed me, as we used to call it. I don't know if it's still called that, but basically changed my Google rankings so that if you looked me up, what you got was all of their pages claiming that I was anti-trans, anti-LGBT rights, anti-intersex rights, that I wanted to send intersex people to the gas chambers, that I was part of a secret Catholic agenda because of my family. They went after my parents. They went after my sister, who's a conservative Roman Catholic nun and a physician. They sent me threatening things with regard to my kid. It was extremely unpleasant. It meant that I discovered that people like Mike, who went through this kind of thing, I discovered later, because that this is what impelled me to end up doing the book, but I discovered that they either exercised too much or they used drugs and alcohol in terms of anti-anxiety pills as well as alcohol. I found, why choose? So I started triathloning that plant.
Oh.
But I also used Xanax for a while, which I no longer like as a drug, but alcohol, the whole nine yards. It was very, very, very stressful. Although it wasn't as stressful as some of the stuff I got into later, but it did, you know, I had two choices. One was hide and the other was proceed. And I figured the only way that I would maintain my reputation as a scholar was to keep working. And so Steve Pinker, who's a scientist at Harvard, had read my work on Bailey because he had been one of the people they came after. He had given a positive review to Mike's book back in 2003. So he read my account of it, and he said it was such a page-turner, fascinating account and such good research that he offered me an introduction to his agent to do a book just about the Bailey situation. And I told him, well, I want to try to go for a Guggenheim Fellowship and try to get some creds to my name because I'd given up tenure. I was unsure if I would even be able to keep this job at Northwestern after what I had uncovered, just because those people were so angry and coming after me. So I ended up getting a Guggenheim Fellowship to do this book, which was to wander around and talk to other scientists who had been through this kind of thing to try to get a sense of what should they do, where are they, when they get attacked, what should they do? What should the activists do? And I was still sympathetic to activists in general. I was still doing intersex rights work on the side. So that's what I did, was set out to do that and ended up taking what turned out to be an 8-year journey tracking all this stuff.
You're listening to Science for the People, and I'm talking about the new book, Galileo's Middle Finger, with author Alice Dreger. And we'll be back with more after this.
Science for the People is a weekly radio show exploring everyday life from a scientific perspective. To find out where Science for the People airs near you, or to listen to past episodes, check out our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. You'll also find links to connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Google+, or to subscribe to the podcast in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Science for the People. This is Desiree Schell, and I'm joined by Alice Dreger, a professor of clinical medical humanities and bioethics at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine, and she's the author of Galileo's Middle Finger: Heretics, Activists, and the Search for Justice in Science. Before the break, we were talking about Bailey being targeted for doing controversial research, and you got a Guggenheim Fellowship to pursue other cases like this, academics who had produced scholarship offensive to an identity group. So you spoke to people that were researching the evolutionary history of rape, others who did a meta-analysis of the research on child sexual abuse and claimed that it didn't always lead to long-term psychological harm. Let me say, those sections in the book were intense. But we won't talk about those. We are going to talk about Napoléon Chagnon. So who was he, and what work would we know him for?
Chagnon is a cultural anthropologist, but also became a biological anthropologist, which means somebody who tries to study the biological factors within a culture. He is from Michigan and, again, lives part-time in Michigan, but he is famous for the work that he did in the 1960s through the 1980s, looking at the Yanomami people in South America. They live where Brazil meets Venezuela. And until Chagnon went into the field in the 1960s, they had very little contact with outsiders. There had been some, but not a huge amount. So they were a group that was fairly untouched in terms of Western culture. And Chagnon went in and tried to understand what their culture looked like. And he then generalized it to some degree to other human cultures because he believed that they were in some ways an insight into our evolutionary past. And the reason he was attacked was because of his promotion of sociobiology. Sociobiology is the idea that you can look at biology of a species and understand its cultural behaviors by looking at the evolutionary history of that biology. So it was more controversial than it is today, but it was very controversial when Chagnon was a big supporter of it, which was in the 1970s in particular, and 1980s. And Chagnon had a group of anthropologists come after him who were upset with him promoting sociobiology with the idea of there being a human nature. Chagnon was particularly interested in the question of whether or not violent males might have more offspring. And his data has been questioned by people who are sympathetic to his politics and his science and his methodology, but and have been questioned by them. In fact, his own colleagues have questioned it. So I don't want to imply that his work is sort of accepted as being just the way it is. But his work was very controversial in part because he was looking at human violence potentially as something that was evolved in us. And so this group of anthropologists had been going after him for years, but had not had too much of an effect on him other than trying to sort of shout him down and keep him from giving presentations at conferences and that sort of thing. But what happened was they teamed up with a self-styled journalist, Patrick Tierney, right around the turn of the century. So in 2000, Tierney had this book coming out called Darkness in El Dorado, with W.W. Norton, and also he did a New Yorker article based on the book. And what he accused Chagnon and also this geneticist, very famous geneticist, James Neal, of doing in the 1960s was having gone into Yanomami territory and purposely used a supposedly bad measles vaccine to purposely spread measles among the Yanomami to then sort of sit back and watch who would live and who would die, to run a sick Nazi-like eugenics experiment. And the evidence is strongly against this. Within months of Tierney's work becoming public, the National Academy of Sciences, all these other disciplinary scientific groups, the University of Michigan, all did investigations and all found that this wasn't true. But Tierney's work definitely had legs, in part because the American Anthropological Association, which is the nation's largest group of anthropologists, decided to go after Chagnon. Neal had died at that point just a few months before. But to go after Chagnon and essentially run an ethics prosecution case against him, even though their own bylaws said you weren't supposed to be able to do that. But they did, and they went after Chagnon and made him quite miserable and sort of persecuted him for a couple of years. When I came to that story, I didn't want to have to spend the time sorting through sort of what had happened in the 1960s, in part because I accepted the findings of all these scientific groups. Everybody except the American Anthropological Association found that Tierney's book was full of holes. So I became interested in the question, why didn't the AAA, why didn't the American Anthropological Association find the same thing? And I started digging into that. Well, as I dug into that, and again, it turned into a year of research and started interviewing lots and lots of people and trying to figure out what had happened with all of this, I ended up finding out what the truth was that the people inside the AAA knew Tierney's book was full of holes. They knew it was, as one of them put it, just a piece of sleaze. But they decided to go forward anyway because they felt that Chagnon had given anthropology a bad reputation and they sort of had to do a ritual cleansing and kick Chagnon's ass in order to sort of save the public view of anthropology. And I was absolutely appalled by that. I mean, Chagnon is a rough character. He drinks, he swears, he's kind of sexist. He calls me dude, which people tell me is a compliment because he would never compliment a woman. So calling me dude is apparently a sign that he respects me.
He repeatedly called you his assistant when you traveled.
Yeah, as a joke, but it was a very irritating joke. He's rough around the edges. Of course, I'm rough around the edges too. So in some ways, I was sympathetic to him in that way. But what happened to him was ridiculous. And there is no excuse for what the AAA did. And I use it as an example of what kinds of stuff happens within academia when we're led by politics and not by a pursuit of the evidence. And I was extremely upset and disturbed by finding all these anthropologists who were very postmodern in their point of view and had the attitude, you know, representations are what matters. And so if Chagnon had made representations that were upsetting, whether or not he was guilty of something, we had to then represent him as problematic.
Well, and I assume as a result of your investigation, he has now been elected a member of the National Academy of Sciences, and he's a professor at the University of Missouri-Columbia?
Yeah, he came out of retirement and took a job after my work. But also his memoir was finally finished at that point. After I published my work, he got his memoir done, and so that really helped too. He would say, and I would agree, he was elected to the National Academy of Sciences because of his work. That said, it's interesting that it took many years for him to actually get elected. And I was told by somebody on the inside that they took the work that I had published in a journal article before this book came out and had passed it around. And that happened to be the year he finally got elected. He finally went over the edge of the number he needed and got elected. Now, he when interviewed by my local paper, Chagnon told them that my work was kind of irrelevant because all these people had cleared him before. So he would disagree with any of this characterization. But I will say I found that investigation just as upsetting as the Bailey one, because people who should have known better were doing such crazy things so counter to the truth. It was just very disconcerting to see human beings behave in this way, particularly scholars. Because in the case of the Bailey situation, two of the three women who came after him were housed in universities and should have behaved in a way that was more attentive to the evidence. And certainly in the case of the American Anthropological Association, what happened there was absolutely appalling.
During your research into that case and others, another one fell in your lap. Can you briefly walk us through your experience researching a fetal intervention for congenital adrenal hyperplasia?
Yeah.
I know briefly is sort of...
No, I'm laughing because, you know, this was never supposed to be part of this book. And it ended up delaying the publication of the book by about 3 or 4 years because of what I ended up getting into. In 2009, just as I was putting out the work that I had done on Chagnon, the year-long research, I was starting to present that work. Some old colleagues of mine from the intersex rights movement, including some clinicians, contacted me and said, we have a really unique problem we have not been able to solve. It's upsetting us all and we need your help. And they said to me, and it's true, they said, you work in sort of different creative kind of ways in terms of trying to deal with political situations and we could really use your help. So what was going on was there's this one condition that can cause intersex in females. I mean, there's many conditions, but the one that's at issue here is called congenital adrenal hyperplasia. We all have adrenal glands in the back of our bodies near the kidneys. And what these glands do is they put out various kinds of hormones that help keep us healthy. One of the type of hormones they put out is androgens. That's why they're called adrenal glands. And androgens in a high enough quantity can cause your body to go more towards the masculine spectrum. So if you have, for example, if you're a female and you have arm hair, underarm hair, pubic hair, that's all a sign that you have androgens in your body and that's responding. In the womb, if you have a higher level of androgens, all other things being equal, you'll get male genital development and more male typical brain development. There's some ways in which the brain is somewhat sexually bifurcated. It's not exact and it's not as much as some people might think, but it affects the brains and the genitals in development. And so if you have a female who has this condition called congenital adrenal hyperplasia, or CAH, it means that the adrenals will be in high gear in the womb. And as a consequence, the female fetus's sex parts may develop along an intersex type, an in-between type, or even head towards the male type. And the brain will presumably do the same sort of thing. And so this causes an intersex condition in some of the females. It varies a lot. You can have very female typical, or you can even have very male typical. It varies case by case. And not all types of CAH cause this, but the one we're talking about does. And so a group of researchers in the 1980s figured out that they might be able to give women who were at risk for having a child with this condition, they could give them a steroid called dexamethasone, or Dex for short, and that would interrupt the high level of androgens, reduce the effects of that, and so you might get a female typical development. And this wasn't studied well. They just started doing it in practice. And there was one particular researcher in the United States, a pediatric endocrinologist who's a member of the National Academy of Sciences, named Maria New. And Dr. New was, in 2009 when I was called into this, she was doing two things. On the one hand, she was telling the parents that this had been found safe for mother and child. And on the other hand, she was taking NIH funding to try to figure out whether or not it was safe for mother or child. And so there was this total doublespeak going on. On the one hand, the parents being brought into this treatment system on the basis of claiming that good science had been done and it was found to be perfectly safe. And on the other hand, going and getting federal funding to see whether or not it was safe. And it was unclear to me whether or not the parents understood that they were basically entering into an experiment and they were going to be used later to see what really happened to their children.
Okay, well, let's go back a second. What does science say about Dex and fetuses?
Animal research tells us Dex is a scary drug to use on fetuses. It suggests to us, for example, in primates, that there are brain effects that are quite significant and can lead to all sorts of brain problems. It also, in rats, has led to cleft palate and cleft lip. We didn't see that in the humans, so the assumption was that that wouldn't happen in the humans. But in 2009, when I was brought into this, there was data finally coming out of a good study in Sweden. Sweden's the only place where this has been studied appropriately. It's a small study, but what that was showing was they finally published the work in 2012. In the Swedish study, out of 43 kids, 7% of them had mental retardation from being exposed to Dex in this way. And 18% of them had severe adverse event rates, meaning that there was about a 1 in 5 chance that a child would have some medical problem so significant that they would be hospitalized.
And this information was not being shared with the pregnant women who were using Dex then?
No, New was telling them that her outcome studies, which are deeply problematic in their own way, hadn't shown this, so it couldn't be true. And what I found after I ended up doing a 3-year-long investigation in that case and using the Freedom of Information Act to get lots of internal information, was that news outcome study in terms of the cognitive function actually had an exemption in the study, which meant that if you couldn't answer the questions of the study, you couldn't be in the study. And if you're mentally retarded, you wouldn't be able to answer the questions in the study. So her study was basically designed so that you wouldn't find mental retardation, whereas the Swedish study was an open-ended study looking at cognitive as well as metabolic effects and finding huge amounts of problems. New, of course, says she, you know, that's not what her data shows, so it's not what her data shows, and she doesn't know why the Swedish data shows this, but the Swedish data was so bad that the Swedish group actually shut down the entire study. You can no longer get dexamethasone for this purpose in Sweden, even if you ask for it. Even if you're willing to sign into a study, you cannot get it. It's considered so risky, you shouldn't even research it. We should say, by the way, that the only way that this can work, because sex starts to bifurcate by about the 7th week of fetal life, means you have to hit the mother as soon as you know she's pregnant. And so the women being given dexamethasone for this are given it as early as week 2 of pregnancy, which means it's just a tiny embryo at that point. And trying to get the dose right of a steroid and trying to hit only what you're expecting to hit, which is the brains and the genitals, and not affecting any other organ, is almost impossible. It is impossible. And the researchers looking at this were freaking out because they were saying, you're giving this big dose of a steroid 60 to 100 times what would naturally occur in terms of the glucocorticoids in the embryo. And you're doing this also in a case that only 1 out of 8 of the embryos will even have the condition you're aiming for, because it's an autosomal recessive, which means that only 1 in 8 of these fetuses will be a female with CAH. So 7 out of 8 of the kids being hit with this in week 2 and beyond don't even have the condition. It's just mind-boggling crazy. I mean, just completely mind-bogglingly crazy. And it's amazing it ever happened.
So you approached the FDA and the Office for Human Research Protections, right?
I did, and with a group of colleagues. I organized a group of colleagues into a team that wrote letters to the FDA and the OHRP, the Office for Human Research Protections, thinking that they would see what we were seeing and say, this is outrageous, and the mothers should be told what's really going on, and you should not be doing this outside of the strictest clinical trials, and everybody should be doing this in the above board way. And instead, what happened was they poked around a little and they said, well, she's not personally writing the prescriptions because she gets the obstetricians to do the prescriptions, and doctors are allowed to use drugs off label, which means this is not an FDA approved use. So there's nothing wrong with that. And, you know, she has permission to do the retrospective studies when you look back and see what actually happened to these poor families. And she had approval at the beginning to sort of do a drug treatment trial. As it turns out, I can't find any evidence anybody was actually enrolled in that. They were just given it through their obstetricians and not actually enrolled in the study. So they didn't look at what I looked at when I did 3 years of investigation. They could have done it in a couple months. It was hard for me because I had to fight with lawyers to get the internal stuff that I was due under the law. But they could have found exactly what I found, which was that it was all a big, disgusting game, to be honest, where these parents were being brought in, told that this was safe, over and over again told it was safe, and then used for federal research dollars to see whether or not it was safe. It's just disgusting, to be honest. I mean, it's the most disgusting thing I came across in my entire book. And you might wonder, well, how does it fit in the book? Because here's not a case of a researcher being persecuted by terrible activists, unless you consider me a terrible activist. I guess I am one. But part of the reason I told that story in that book was to make clear, I am not saying that scientists should get out of jail free cards. The other side of academic freedom is academic responsibility. And there are still cases all over this country where people are doing genuinely unethical things and are getting away with it.
This is Science for the People, and I'm speaking with Alice Dreiger, author of Galileo's Middle Finger, Heretics, Activists, and the Search for Justice in Science. Okay, well, now, while all the cases that you've written about are tremendously fascinating, I can't speak to the science, but you yourself are very clear in that you don't think that they're all settled science either. You point out repeatedly that you don't necessarily agree with some of the positions taken by people that you've defended.
That's right. And I don't even think of it as defending them. I think what I'm defending is the research process, the ability to do research, to publish unpopular results, to use unpopular methodologies even, you know, to do so in a fashion that's socially responsible, but that what we seek out can't scare us, and we can't shut people down because what they're researching makes us uncomfortable. So really, when, I mean, I know people say, oh, you defended Bailey or you defended Chagnon. I always tell them, no, I didn't really. I defended the process. And if what defending the process means is I'm defending their rights, then okay, then I'm defending them, right? But what I'm really interested in is defending the rights of researchers and also making sure that we understand that there is that other side of things, that with freedom of research also comes the need to be responsible in every way, shape, and form. So I think that's critically important to understand as you approach this stuff.
Well, what bothers you most about these cases or events? I'm not sure what to call them.
I think what bothers me most is when people have evidence before them that pretty clearly tells them they're wrong and that what they're claiming about somebody isn't true, and they refuse to acknowledge that. In fact, that bothers me so much, and you've read the book, so you know this. When the FDA and the OHRP investigations came out and they said that I was wrong, that there was nothing wrong going on with Dr. New's work, and at the same time, the American Journal of Bioethics published a piece against me and my colleagues saying that we had been unethical because we'd made all sorts of claims that they said weren't true, I was so committed and am so committed to the idea that you have to face facts even when you're wrong, that I thought I was completely wrong. And to be honest, my agent and my editor made me cut it out of the book, but I became suicidal at that point because I thought I had so screwed up that I had made accusations that were untrue, that I supposedly should have known were untrue. It was such an incredibly unsettling event. It completely upended my sense of self. And it was only my partner, as well as my closest colleague, Ellen Fader. They're two different people. My partner is Aaron Souza, and my closest colleague is Ellen Fader at American University. When the two of them said to me over and over again, they didn't say you were wrong. They said they didn't find anything to agree with you, but that doesn't mean you were wrong. And they both said to me, you've got to go back and look at what we can know. And set me down that path of doing 3 more years of historical research into that case, that I began to sort of climb out of that hole and realize that what I had done wasn't unethical, and that, in fact, I hadn't even been wrong. I had been more right than I had ever realized, and found smoking gun after smoking gun in news grants as well as in the FDA and the OHRP investigation, and didn't realize I was being kind of set up by that whole group in a way that's, I mean, it makes it sound like I'm a believer of conspiracy theories, but when I found out that the FDA official was in cahoots with the American Journal of Bioethics and that they had timed their stuff to come out, timed it to all come out the same day and to make me think I was an idiot and make me look terribly, terrible nationally, that was all a setup. It sounds kind of crazy. I'm saying this stuff and I'm thinking, I must sound like I'm crazy. But that's why the book, I think people say the book reads like a thriller in part, because of the stuff that keeps happening is so freaking unbelievable to other people as well as myself. So many people said the book really should have been called I Am Not Making This Up.
Well, if even a part of what you claim about Dex is true, then there are pregnant mothers out there who are not making informed decisions about their participation in what is effectively a research experiment that they don't even know that they're involved in.
And it's unbelievable. I mean, the government knows this is going on and has chosen to do nothing. And I should say, I've since found out I'm not special. The FDA and the OHRP have totally fallen down on the job of protections of people and experiments. And this is not special. There's all sorts of ways in which people are not being protected in research subjects. This great reporter out of Washington, Teresa DeFino, has been watching what's going on with the OHRP. She's FOIA'd, used the Freedom of Information Act to get all the information. What we found out is last year, in the 2014 calendar year, the OHRP opened only one investigation, which is ridiculous. OHRP only finding one research study worth investigating in the entire United States. And it's not because complaints are down. Complaints like the kind of complaint I filed are actually holding steady at pace. And yet, a couple years ago, under a different director, OHRP was doing dozens and dozens of investigations every year. And now they're just doing one a year. The FDA, similarly, has just been falling down on the job. There's a bill before Congress right now that is seeking to roll back research protections. It's claiming that for certain types of research studies, you don't need to bother to tell people they're in the study. I mean, I'm not making this up. It is a complete collapse of the system of research protections done in the name of science.
How should social justice and science work together? Because you obviously want them to, but let's be honest, science is often very slow, and people are being marginalized and exploited and hurt now.
Yeah, it is slow. You're right. Science is slow because if we do it well, then we have to repeat and we have to check and we have to double check and we have to try new populations to see if it holds up under new populations, whatever the finding is we have. I think one of the things that has to happen in the future is more partnerships between activists and scientists to try to have the activists articulate the questions that would actually get us the kinds of scientific data that we could then use for social policy. The challenge there is influence, that just because activists may not have a lot of money doesn't mean they may not have a sort of undue influence over scientists. So we've got to try to find a way that activists can help articulate the questions that will result in meaningful social policy that will be sustainable. And then we have to find scientists willing to do that. And we have some places where that's working. So, for example, LGBT youth now, there's a lot of folks who are activists helping to articulate questions about risk-taking behaviors among LGBT youth that we can try to figure out and try to figure out how to curb them. So my colleague at Northwestern, Brian Mostansky, is doing really fine work trying to understand, for example, why do young gay men have unprotected sex, even though they know that HIV is still very much out there and very dangerous. And so he's working with the Chicago activist groups to try to articulate questions that can actually get to some knowledge of why do young gay men still, many of them, have high-risk sex. And what can we do to try to reduce those rates of high-risk sex in an effort to try to reduce their dangers? So I think we can go to places like that. The challenge is going to be always that some of the most interesting questions are not going to be questions that social justice activists will be satisfied with. And social justice activists often don't have the science that they need to get sustainable policies done. So it's a struggle.
What about when what science determines is correct actively marginalizes people? As a science historian, you know that history has a plethora of examples of that, including the treatment history of intersex. So there are communities who have valid reasons not to trust science at all. So how do you convince those folks that science will ultimately help serve their interests if they can learn to harness it?
Well, it can be difficult, but there are partnerships now within intersex between the support groups and actual scientists trying to figure out some of the stuff, for example, trying to figure out some of the genetic issues that go on, trying to understand cancer rates with certain intersex conditions. So there are some partnerships going on there. But I think a healthy suspicion of each other is not necessarily a bad thing. That said, it's really interesting because social justice activists today and scientists should in many ways be natural political allies. The reason being, they're almost all on the left. So if you survey scientists, particularly scientists working in human behavioral work, they're almost all progressives in terms of their own personal politics. And that's where most social justice activists are as well, is they tend to be gathered towards the left. So naturally speaking, they should actually be able to sit down over coffee or beer and get along with each other. Maybe we need more opportunities to do that. But part of the problem is that the scientists are worried about going near activists because they feel like if they take even the slightest wrong step, the activists will come after them. And the activists are sort of worried about working with the scientists because sometimes they're seen as selling out when they do that. So that can be a problem. But I think, you know, what I'm trying ultimately to tell people in this book is that we don't have any choice. Science and social justice have to be protected together. The reason being, you cannot do good science if you don't have a just system. If people are going to unjustly persecute you, you cannot do good science. We can see that with Galileo, but we can also see it with Chagnon, for example, with what the American Anthropological Association did. So you have to have a just system in order to do science. And at the same time, you really have to have science to do good social justice, because you're not going to get sustainable social justice work if you don't know what's true. You can come up with every theory you want to come up with about how gender works, how sex works, how violence works, how race works, how all of it works. But if you don't know how the real world operates, then whatever you come up with isn't going to be sustainable. So I think that's critically important.
Well, but that said, science changes too. It's supposed to, given new evidence. But your work on intersex shows that you can push a stagnant scientific community via activism to consider other avenues. But it's so especially sensitive when we're doing activism around areas of unsettled or non-consensus science.
Absolutely, yeah. And that's going to be the most interesting places. So it's going to be the place we're naturally drawn to in some ways, because those are the points where things, I think, are the most interesting. Yeah, at the end of the day, I think what has to happen is we all have to have an allegiance to reality. and again, I know this sounds terribly radical, but I think at the end of the day, we have to find some common principles we can agree on. And I think there are several. I mean, I think freedom of speech, freedom from oppression, and the ability to go out and face reality and not live in a self-serving world in terms of what we believe to be true. These are things we can all, at the end of the day, I hope, agree on. And trying to work from there in terms of how we treat each other is the way to go. And not just scream at each other and inhabit our favorite little spots on the internet and be outraged about various things. You know, it's the case for me now that when I get 10,000 tweets or emails on some particular subject and people say, oh, this is so outrageous, I really always say to myself, what do we really know about what's true? Right. So the most recent one was this weekend where there was this understandable outrage among women scientists and our allies because there'd been this NPR story and this astrophysicist, I think it's an astrophysicist, had referred to boys and their toys as being what science was about. And women scientists understandably hate that phrase because, you know, girls should be allowed to play with boys, so-called boys' toys, and we do science. And so why use that? But there's this huge outrage. I went back to the original story, and it was one line in the story that, granted, the interviewer should have paused and said, well, girls and women do science as well, right? And he didn't, so he lost that opportunity. But to be perfectly honest, the level of outrage felt to me a little out of sync with what this guy had actually said and what the interviewer had failed to do. And I get that we want to reiterate that, you know, women are perfectly capable of doing science, that girls should be allowed to investigate the world however they want to investigate the world, even if, gasp, that's physics or astronomy, right, which is traditionally associated with males. We should be able to do that. But at the same time, I just, looking at the original, I was surprised to see how minor a comment it was in the scale of things. And again, you know, I'm fully in support of the women who wanted to point out that women and girls should be able to do whatever science they want, because I was one of those girls who was oppressed in that way. When I was in seventh grade for the science fair, I wanted to study surface tension, which is a physics problem. And my teacher told me I should study how radishes grow in different soil.
Wow.
I mean, I've been through that, right? I've been through that. And I might have become a person in physics if I had not been steered in that direction. As it is, they steered me into biology, which they steered all girls at the time. And biology didn't fascinate me that much, except as a historical subject. So I ended up in history of science. I might have been a physicist, you know, but I was directed in that other way. And so I'm sensitive to that as well. But in some ways, I think going back to the original and trying to see what did somebody actually say and reacting in a way that's sort of in keeping with that is perhaps something that makes more sense.
Well, you just mentioned free speech, and there was a point in your book that I was wondering about. You were talking about the value of free scientific inquiry on any and every topic, but then you seemed to shoot down your own example of looking at race and intelligence. So if you promote the idea that nothing should be off limits to science, why would that topic be different? Or did I totally misread that bit?
No, I think you're not misreading it. I mean, I don't think it should be off limits. I think it makes sense that you should study whatever you want to study, but you can sort of look at certain topics and figure that you might cause more harm than you really want to. And I think the way the world actually works, if we study race and IQ, the potential is high there for ending up saying something or finding something that will be misunderstood, misconstrued, and misused. So it's one of those things where I think you should be allowed to do it, but you should also not be naive in terms of how much harm you might do. So the same thing would be true, for example, with the kinds of research that goes into weapon development. So if you're doing a particular kind of study of explosives and you're heading into an area where you're finding that it's possible to develop a new type of explosive that is extremely difficult to detect, say, at security checks, but is extremely powerful, then you would be naive not to recognize that what you're doing is potentially creating a weapon that could be used by terrorists or used by somebody inappropriately in some other way. So I think you have to recognize that there are some topics you can go into, and I will defend your right to research what you want, but that you shouldn't be naive that what you're doing may cause great harm. And that's part of the responsibility, is taking that really seriously.
So basically your entire premise is that we should depend on humans to not be naive?
I know, right?
You're so hooped.
My whole book is all about, and then I was naive again, and then I was naive again, and then I was naive again. I know, it's so ridiculous for me to be saying this. But, you know, it's interesting. The point of the book you're referring to in terms of the moment at which that happened for me, I became sort of drunk with the idea that we should research anything. And I remember I called Mike Bailey up at that point. I was like, I think I should create a new journal called the Journal of Dangerous Ideas. And it should be an editorial board of all these people like you and me who've gotten in trouble for researching dangerous ideas. And there's this dead silence on the other end of the phone. And then Mike said to me, Alice, shouldn't all journals be journals of dangerous ideas? And I felt so stupid because I realized, of course, he was right, right? That I was assuming that somehow dangerous ideas needed to be cordoned off from the rest of the world. And that's exactly what doesn't need to happen.
Alice, just tremendous book. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Desiree. This has been really fun.
And that was Alice Dreger, author of Galileo's Middle Finger, Heretics, Activists, and the Search for Justice in Science. And we've linked to Alice and her book on our site at scienceforthepeople.ca. Science for the People is recorded in Edmonton, Alberta. The show is produced by Rochelle Saunders. Ryan Bromsgrove is our promotions manager. Our social media manager is Chelsea Butler. K.O. Myers updates our website. Helen Quivillon is our publishing liaison. Ed Haynes is our guest coordinator. We get research help from Josh Witten. The show is edited by K.O. Myers and Ryan Bromsgrove. Our theme song was written and recorded by Fractal Pattern, and its title is Binary Consequence. The show is hosted by Rochelle Saunders, Marie-Claire Shanahan, and me, Desiree Shell.